You are listening to a podcast of Ice and Fire, episode 236, for the week of November 25th, 2018. Welcome back to the longest running podcast dedicated to George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, and occasionally HBO's Game of Thrones. As usual, this is Amin, and today we're joined by returning guest host, senior board game producer Jason Walden from Fantasy Flight Games. Welcome, Jason.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Excellent.
Well, we have our usual Arbor Gold and Dornish Red here, a few casks of that, but we actually have added some Tsurushi Pear Brandy, so we've got a little more selection here.
All right.
We're moving up the ranks here, and we're excited to chat with you again about the upcoming, this episode will be released exactly when it comes out, but the recently released expansion Mother of Dragons for the Game of Thrones the Board Game 2nd Edition. So, there's some new houses added in this expansion. Can you tell us about the new houses?
Yes, we did. We added two very important houses. Well, obviously, the namesake of the expansion, Mother of Dragons. This, we've added the Targaryens. Long a house that everyone's been wanting to play, but we just didn't have enough material to go off of, or at least when the original game first came out, and as well as the previous two expansions. So we patiently waited for George to release more stuff, and in a roundabout way, he did, with last book, with The Worlds of Ice and Fire, with recently Fire and Blood, though we didn't pull from that. We didn't have enough access to that early, so I didn't pull a lot from Fire and Blood, but Dany wasn't in Fire and Blood, I think, anyway, so.
It's a recent timeline of the Targaryens.
Yeah. It's everything to do with Daenerys Targaryen. So there's two different timelines that you can play in the game. Once you buy this expansion, you can play two different timelines. You can play the early Game of Thrones, which is roughly about the time that the Game of Thrones book starts. You know, Eddard is still alive, all that stuff. And Dany is often in exile. And then there's a later version, which you have to own the Dance with Dragons expansion as well. If you do own that, you can play the later version, and all the houses upgrade to the decks found in Dance with Dragons, their Dance with Dragons cards. And then the House Targaryen cards that come with this expansion also have a later deck. And that will be the later stage of her ascension to power. So Khal Drogo is gone. Viserys is gone. She rises from a 1 strength to a 4 strength, you know.
I didn't even realize that it actually fits a timeline-wise. I had realized that you were going to give the options for the two different card bases, but actually it fits the timeline.
That's
interesting.
If you recall the Dance with Dragons, spoiler alert, you know, sorry, I'm going
to... Oh, I mean, everyone who's listening to this, I'll put a spoiler alert, but we're going to talk all spoilers from the 5 books. So
good. So in the Dance with Dragons expansion, all of the houses previously, besides Targaryen, because they weren't in yet, but all of the houses got a later deck. And so the Stark deck, for example, became the kind of Bolton deck because the Boltons took over in the north. So you had Ramsay and Roose and Walder Frey and all those guys with no Starks. So that deck, that little Roose Bolton deck, kind of the Ramsay Bolton deck, can play with the later Targaryen deck, which is Dany in power and old Khal Drogo, etc. It also has Stannis Baratheon up at the wall. Renly and Robert are gone. So yeah, there is a later stage where all of that stuff that happened in between books like 1 and 4, you can kind of speed up to like book 5-ish, and play with the characters that you would know from that.
So the Targaryen gameplay is particularly special in this expansion, I think. I mean, I guess there's the map change, and then there's the gameplay itself of that house, right?
Yeah. So I mean, there's a huge map that comes with it, adding Essos, at least the western coast of Essos. So it's got the free cities of Braavos and Pentos and Myr. So it adds a bunch of territory over there, and that's where the Targaryens start. Dany starts in Pentos. We had talked some about doing Slaver's Bay area, but that's so far east that it's just really hard to connect physically.
Put a couple tables together for that. It's going to be huge.
Yeah, yeah. So we put it on the western coast of Essos in Pentos, which does, in the early game, make sense. It's where she is, where she gets married and stuff. And then the later stages, we just take some liberties to say that she that was on her way to Westeros, which it could be from the book standpoint. And again, another thing to make clear is this is not based on the show. It's inspired by the show because we have nothing else to go on at the moment, but it is not based on the show. So Danny's whole arc of launching ships and attacking Westeros, we don't know if that ever will happen, you know? So we have to make some speculations and say, well, you know what? In our game, she went through Pentos and stopped at Pentos.
Yeah, and the board game, I mean, is focused on and Westeros. Even if you add Essos, it's still the interaction going, like, it's impacting. Most of the houses are still on Westeros here. So, but Targaryen itself, it's completely different, as for at least in terms of, I mean, where they are on the tracks and just how they win, even, right?
Oh, yeah. From top to bottom, this is the most unique house to play. So, taking a step back and doing something a little more simple, or talking about something a little more basic, we added House Aaron as well, right?
Yeah.
House Aaron it plays like all the other houses, the same machinations, the same goals, the same way to win, the same, everything's the same, just that they're now squeezed into that map to fight over Westeros. The Targaryens, however, play completely differently. Number one, they have a different victory condition entirely. Everybody else is fighting over castle and stronghold locations on the map. They're having to move around pieces on the board to take over locations that have these marked areas. The Targaryens don't care about castles and strongholds. Instead, they're trying to take over random locations will be slowly, randomly seeded throughout the game that they have to take over for victory points. And unlike the other houses who can lose and gain victory points back and forth as they lose territory, the Targaryens, if they land on one of these spaces with their they're called loyalty tokens. If they land on one of these spaces with their randomly seeded loyalty tokens, they get a permanent victory point. So even if they get kicked off or move, they are one up on that track, one closer to the seven needed to victory. And those will all spawn over on Westeros. None of those spawn on Essos. So it's encouraging them to invade. They are the invaders. And they will be forcing the hand of the other houses as they push inwards towards Westeros.
Well, what I found when I was playing them is they also keep the balance of power, right? They can directly basically kind of push houses out that are weak up to kind of make... As the game goes longer, they get stronger, right?
Oh, yeah.
For a longer game.
So one of the ways they do that, too, is their dragons. Another unique feature for them. They have three dragons. Just three. They're units, just like all their units. Only they operate a little bit uniquely. They start the game at zero strength. Other units are one or two strength. They start at zero, and every two rounds, all three of them will increase in strength by one. So every other round, they'll get one stronger. And so by round five, they're going to be upwards of they're going to be four or three strength each. So that's a pretty strong unit. But in addition to that, they can fly, which means they can just march to anywhere they want on the other board and just land wherever they want. They can start a combat with a fly. They can just fly right in and attack wherever they want to. Or they can march on land like a regular unit. And that's really strong. So they can't bring anything with them when they fly. Like they can't put the other units on their back and fly them over there. But they can surgically strike if they need to at open spaces. And it works through as a really great force against the other factions as they kind of work as a counterbalance to anyone who might be kind of taking advantage of a weak spot on the board. The Targaryens can strike in with those dragons and put them back in their place.
Well, they can save a game. I mean, often sometimes what can happen is somebody is pretty much going to win and no one can get there in time, but the Targaryens can, if need be, they can, because they want to win themselves, they'll go and do it.
Yeah, the one dangerous thing about the dragons is that they can't. If they die, they die permanently. So you only have three, and you want them to get stronger. So does she protect the quandary then for the Targaryen player is: do you protect your dragons as they're young and weak? If they're flying around at zero or one strength, you can still fly around and take things for zero and one strength. But do you want to risk them getting killed?
Well, you march last, I believe, right? You're last on the Iron Throne, so you have to keep in mind what happened. You can't just think, I'm going to make this attack. What am I going to do next turn? It has to be on your mind, I think. And that the other players can keep an eye on that. If can you trap a dragon? It's a whole side game to try to kill off a dragon.
Yeah. Or a dragon hunting. Dragon hunting is always an interesting little thing that people start to realize. And even if a Targaryen player wants to keep him safe by keeping them over on Essos, which they can totally do, I love it when players kind of talk, hey, you know what, let's go dragon hunting. And they'll kind of gang up together, bring some forces together, and team up to try to crush the dragons on the ground. It's hard to do, and it's almost not even a great strategy, I will admit, but it's fun to listen to the players debate that.
Is there, dragons don't normally come back, but I think there's like one card that can bring them back? Or something?
Yes. So they have a fourth Westeros deck that we added, and in that's where they generate their loyalty tokens from. So the board will be seeded with their victory points that they have to go fetch through that deck. And the deck does a couple of different things too. One of the things it can do, one of the 10 cards, is that if you have a dead dragon, you can respawn them. That's the only other way a dead dragon can come back.
Can you? Is it just one, or is it multiple? Like, how does it work? Like,
looking at the card right now, Firemaid Flesh. The Targaryen player may either destroy one dragon to move any dragon strength token from the round marker to the dragon strength box, or place a destroyed dragon in their home area. So that first option allows you to increase the strength of all dragons at the cost of one dragon.
Hmm.
Or you can just spawn a dead dragon back at your home area.
So you can get that one back. Now, is that... how many cards are there in the deck for? There's 10?
10, just like the other decks.
So is it possible... So even in a full game, you could still... There's a chance you might not get it, I think, right? Because I think
yeah,
the game only
yeah.
has 9 cards, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah,
so that affects it. That's interesting. I mean, like, just the fact that the placements of these Targaryen tokens varies per game, changes every game. Because it's not
yep.
exact, right? It's the randomized thing.
So okay. We'll get there, but sure. There is a... I like the effect of searching through the Westeros decks and manipulating those to your advantage. So there is a card in the Iron Bank deck that allows you to do that now.
Is that any of the three, you mean, or is it...
any of the four.
Any of the four, okay.
Yeah.
That reminds me of the... Because you had a similar card in I think, Dance of Dragons, the Reader, right?
That was Roderick the Reader, yeah. Greyjoy card, can also do that, yep.
And that was one of my favorite cards, so you've kind of used that mechanic now for
yep.
Iron Bank, which I guess we'll get to. I mean, there's
yep.
a lot we'll
get
to talk
there.
About,
yeah.
which, I mean, that's what's really exciting about this expansion. It's the biggest change to the game. I mean,
huge,
even more
yeah.
than the second edition, if you think of it. Look at the Targaryens, right? It's a whole different playstyle, right? So...
Yeah, if you look at the difference between first edition and second edition, and second edition and this expansion, I think there's actually more change going into this expansion than there was from first edition to second edition.
Yeah, because of all these different, you know, the Targaryens are special in that way. I mean, Aaron, we'll just wrap up Aaron since we talked about them. Like, they also have a map change, which is important, right? They're not just
yep.
squeezed in there, which is, so they have a port, right? In that area.
Two map changes, actually,
yeah.
Two overlays, one of which gives them an extra area. In the area of the Eyrie, they actually add another land area to that space, which gives them an extra castle and a port and I think a power icon, I believe. So they kind of give them some more reinforcement. So that home area there is just like everybody else's; it's just as strong. But then the other thing is we actually split that sea zone, which is the narrow sea right outside the Aaron home area. We split that into two. Up kind of north, just north of it, we cut that, put a cutting dividing line, which creates the Bight, a new sea area. And that gives a port, that gives the port of Winterfell, which, or the port of White Harbor, which the Stark usually controls, that gives them their own sea area there. So the two ports aren't fighting over the same sea area.
Yeah, and I like the fact, because it's more space there, there's more options. It's not always that the two, Stark and Aaron, must fight. They could want to bypass
yeah.
the other. And, mm-hmm. and have, like, that's more flex, and go to Essos or go around south. So, the theme of the Aaron card seems to be pretty, they have strong defense, right? Is that the kind of the idea?
Oh, yeah. Really strong. they were an interesting one to make. Like, so the Aaron deck from A Feast for Crows, that is the later deck that can be combined with the Dance of Dragons and the later Targaryen cards. The deck that's in this expansion is the earlier deck. So this is the deck you'd play with the base game cards.
Hmm.
This deck, that later deck, the later Aryan deck that came with Dance of Dragon, or Feast of Crows, that was the power-hungry deck. It all revolved around gaining power and having more power than everybody else. This deck revolves around defense, heavy, heavy defense. As the Aryan player is kind of pinched in that area between a couple of different factions, I felt like it was a really cool... placed out to play defensively and to try to take land and then, you know, bunker down and hold that land as long as you can.
Yeah, and being able to defend with less troops actually lets you then move elsewhere without being as worried, right? So that's
yeah.
kind of interesting. That so both the new houses have kind of, I mean, I'm not, what would you say the Targaryen kind of theme is? I mean, I think some of the cards still interplay with each other, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. The two different Targaryen decks play a little bit differently, but throughout both, there are some interesting effects regarding the permanent removal of cards. Mm. For example, in the 7-card deck that is the early deck for them, they have 3 cards that can leave entirely. So they can pare down their deck to only 4 cards.
That's not necessarily bad because you can keep cycling, right?
I guess. Oh, yeah. Two of the ones that you could remove, Viserys and Illyrio, are a 1 and a 0. So you can get rid of your low cards and hope to keep your high cards.
Yeah, and I mean, then going still keeping in mind the Targaryen gameplay, it doesn't matter at the end if you have almost no territories. What matters is you've gained influence over time. So you be aggressive and cycling cards a lot, I think, moving around, not only your dragons, but with regular forces.
Yep. So in that earlier deck, Daenerys herself gets a +2 combat if she's in an area with a dragon. So she obviously benefits from a dragon, but she's a 1 strength. So you kind of have to figure out how to best to use her for that. And then in the later Targaryen deck, much stronger Daenerys card. She's a 4 strength. And after combat, your opponent must discard a number of their available power equal to the difference of your combat strengths. So what you obviously want to do is bring in a dragon or two and just dominate your opponent, you know, win by 5 or 6, and then cause them to discard a ton of power. So it's a threat, a really big threat, that not only am I going to beat you if you don't, you know, listen to me and, you know, cow to my demand, I'm going to make you lose a ton of power in the process. So, you know, she can use that threat to her advantage.
Well, I mean, power tokens have never been as important as
all these other super important
things
right
going
now.
On, which we'll get. I mean, there's so much to talk about. I guess let's try to finish off the thing with the dragons. Since we talked about dragons, can we clarify? So when dragons, if they can fly in to attack, but what happens if they lose a battle? Can they fly out, or what's the scenario with that? Like, what's a different scenario if they're attacked and they lose, or if they fly in? I think there's a difference.
Okay, yeah. So you're referring to retreating, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So the all dragon units are subject to all the retreating rules, just like normal. Mm. And the retreating rules state, as an attacker, you have to go back to the area you marched from. Mm. So the dragons can fly back if they lose as an attacker.
Yeah,
they can fly back to the area they came from. However, they can't fly if they're being attacked.
Yes.
So that's where you can really pin them down. They can retreat to an adjacent land area. They can retreat over water, just like a ship bridge, like the normal retreating rules. But they can't use their flying ability when retreating on the defense.
Super vulnerable to the second attack that often hits routed units. Then, I mean, they're typically going to be, if they go somewhere far away, there's nothing safe around them, right?
And that's the big part. Another part, big part about this expansion is with specifically with Daenerys' ability to be everywhere at once. Mm. She can be the ultimate political influencer, and she can gain allies and enemies. Turn after turn, they can switch, and then she can renegotiate, and then she can threaten, and then they can threaten her, and it just creates a ton of table talk. And like, I love that dynamic that introduces.
So, would you think like, typically the Targaryen player, if it's a group of players with varied skill, probably somebody has at least a decent amount of experience with the game, would probably fit it best initially?
You know, I originally thought that when I was designing them, that I was like, oh, this is going to be a tough one to play. And it's very nuanced and different. But that's the interesting part. A new player, which I have had a bunch of people test as the Targaryen player as a new player actually doesn't have the preconceived notions that an experienced player has. Hmm. And so they actually approach that role, that Targaryen role, in a way that's maybe even different or more strategic than an experienced player who's trying to make the Targaryens play like all the other houses.
Yes.
If that makes sense, you know?
Yeah. Well, one of those being that a traditional player thinks I must get as many territories as possible to build up.
Yes.
Those units and territories should be means to an end, not in itself, because you don't win from having a lot of territories. You win by picking up points over time. Yeah. And then the power tokens, I mean, are interesting as well, because they don't have, they're always the same place on the track, so they can use their tokens. I mean, everyone can give tokens now, which is a change, but they can use them in particular to help people bid. Is that
yes? So they can't move on the tracks. They are last place on all 3 tracks. There is a small stipulation that on the Kingscourt track, they do have 3 stars where they're at.
And that's crucial. I mean, if they didn't have stars, it's a huge. Yeah. That's important that they have that. Yeah.
But they can't move. So when it comes to bidding for the influence tracks, they can bid power just like everybody else. Blind bid. They put it in their fists. They put their fists out, reveal the power. But upon reveal, when everyone reveals their tokens for the different tracks, they then distribute the tokens that they've bid anywhere they want amongst the other players, causing them to be shifted up and down. Including vassals, by the way. They can, vassals naturally bid zero. Vassals naturally bid zero, but they can add to that zero, causing the vassals to jump players.
Yeah, this I mean, bid it just makes bids even more interesting. I mean, this Targaryen ability, but plus the ability that players, I mean, I guess before the bid starts, you can transfer money to each other, like before you actually start bidding.
Yes.
It's not at like a specific point of the turn. That's like pretty much any time you could do it. You wouldn't do it in the middle of a bid. I don't think that makes sense. But I mean, like,
no.
Before the bid starts, you can be like, here, have a bunch of tokens. Mm-hmm. You're only going to do that for, I mean, people are not going to just give up their tokens. If tokens are important, yeah. They only would do it for an important reason.
I added that rule later in the process because players kept asking if they could do it. Like the newer, a little bit, some of the newer players that weren't quite experienced with the game, they'd say they'd almost naturally want to do it, but not frequently, but they just every once in a while would say, hey, I'll give you 2 power tokens to attack that guy. Mm-hmm. And then you'd say, no, I'm sorry. That's not a rule. You can't do that. But I thought, you know, why not? Why not just make it a rule? And so We stuck it in there and it worked and players loved it. And it caused a whole bunch of interesting negotiations and political maneuverings that weren't there previously, while not negatively affecting anything. Yeah. So I thought, just go ahead and leave it.
Well,
so.
I mean, tokens do represent, you know, money in some sense, right? Like the ability to spend, so it makes sense thematically. But also, I mean, if I recall the Storm of Swords expansion, you could pay tokens to kind of get your hostage leaders back. Like it's not a problem to exchange tokens. It makes sense to me that mm-hmm. you just expand it to the whole game. Like if it worked there, it doesn't break the game to exchange tokens. If people exchange tokens badly and they lose, well, they won't do that next time. Just they'll do it properly next time. Okay, so we've talked about dragons, we've talked about mustering and stuff. Okay, and just in terms of the map, so we have if you get the expansion, you get these changes to the map, but there's also, you can also get, is there a playmat coming out as well?
Yeah, there's a big 3-foot by 3-foot playmat that adds the main board to the sideboard, reshuffle some tracks into ways to make it more convenient for everybody. And then it also expands the size of the territories. I don't know if a lot of people were aware of that when they first saw it. Each of the entire board, all the map spaces, got about 15% larger. Hmm. So it gives you some more space to play with too.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, so you can, I mean, it's not mandatory to get the playmat. It's just it's a nice bonus. People want to get it.
It's not in the expansion. It's separate, but it's a bonus that you can get if you'd like.
Talking about, since there's Essos here, what do we have with the Iron Bank system?
Ah, the Iron Bank. As we know, the Iron Bank exists in Braavos, and we were adding that the western coast of Essos. We were like, I think it makes sense to put the Iron Bank in there, right? Because it's sitting right there in Braavos, and Braavos is a very important location in the books. Came up with a system where the bank presents the players with loan cards. A loan card, there's 3 of them available at any given time. And each of them have a cost based on the slot that they're on and one of the 3 slots that they're in. So the first slot is a 7 power to purchase it. And then it'll slide down into the 4 power slot and then to the 1 power slot. So it gets cheaper as the game goes on. Hmm. But each of these loans are a one-time purchase. You purchase it and you immediately get its effect. Its effect is usually very strong. There's a bunch of them that just give you straight units. It just lets you get a bunch of free units. There's other ones that let you kill other people's units. There's ones that let you place tokens on the board that actually modify the spaces on the board. So, like, you can add a castle to the board, or you can add a power token to the board, or a barrel. And so they modify the game significantly, but they're expensive. So you still need a lot of power to make those work properly. And those are triggered by a new token type, a new order token type we have called Sea Orders. Mm. Sea Orders are specifically used on seas only. And so you can only place them onto your sea units, onto your ships, basically, that can be placed into the ports or onto the sea themselves. And one of those is an Iron Bank token. So when that is resolved, it resolves during the consolidated power order step. When you resolve it, you can purchase a loan. So it still happens in turn order. You have to choose when you want to resolve that.
Does it go in, you can put it in the port as well? Would that count for?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And
they can be raided too. So
that's right. Yeah. So you got to put them somewhere safe. I mean, the movements with the ships helps in general. I think having another order to move ships around it especially if you don't have stars. Like, you end up if you're low on the tracks.
Yep. Yep. The sea orders don't have any stars on them, so everyone has access to them.
Mm.
And they also have some there's march orders in there. So these sea order tokens that you're getting, you're going to have more ability to move your ships around more freely.
So how does it really vary per game? But would you say on average, like how many loans do you think people take? Is it usually just like one good loan per game, or do people take multiple? Like, does it vary? Or?
I've seen. So here's what happens. Just to finish off the concept of loans. When you take a loan, you pay it that power cost that I was talking about, the cost listed above its space that it's in. Immediately pay that and get its effect. Then you take the loan, you put it in front of you face down. And there's a little reminder on the back of that. There's a reminder that you have to pay one power at the beginning of a turn for every loan you've taken out. And that will never go away. It's just going to stay with you for the rest of the game. And so you'll be minus one power at the beginning of every round for that loan. If you are ever unable to make that one power payment or don't want to, the player who's highest on the fiefdoms track gets to kill one of your units anywhere they want. And so that's kind of the comeuppance of not being able to pay your loan. The Iron Bank basically hires somebody else to come take a hit on you.
So do you keep losing units like that then, or is it one time? I'm not sure.
No, yeah, you keep. If you can't pay it, you keep losing it. So
you better pay the Iron Bank. They'll have its due.
Yeah. Yep.
But something happens if you take Braavos, right? Does that affect it a little bit?
Yes. So Braavos is has a five strength neutral force on it, just like some of the other neutral forces, neutral force tokens in the game. And so you have to beat that five strength token before you take it. And once you take it, you get to flip the token over and keep it in front of you, and it says you get a negative one, or you're going to get a minus one to all of the initial costs that are paid to the Iron Bank for those loans. So the seven spot becomes a six spot for you, and the four spot becomes a three spot. So you get a discount on the loans for capturing and holding Braavos. If somebody else takes it, then they get that token. So anyone who's holding Braavos gets that discount.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to see not only what you might expect is, you know, getting units and stuff, but actually modifying the map is, again, a fundamental change to the game to be able to make, you know, upgrade to Stronghold or add barrels. The one I want to talk about now that I found the most interesting is the Pyromancer, which is take away. So in exchange for taking away a castle, you get a crown and a barrel. And I'm going to pause for a second to let the listeners think, like, what's the potential uses of this card? Because there's several there. So think about what their use is there, and then I'm going to say. So I mean, the obvious use that looking at is you're exchanging a castle for the crown and the barrel. But the one that I used it when I played the game is, you can actually permanently damage somebody else's territories by taking away a victory point from them by losing the castle, right?
Yep. It does not have to be an area you control. It can be anywhere on the map, on either map, Essos or Westeros.
Which is incredible. I mean, it's like, yeah, here, have your extra barrel and crown, but now you're down a victory point. You can't get it back. Like one of your core territories or something, which is really crucial. And I like that kind of outside-the-box application.
And what'll happen is these aren't secret. These aren't secret. They aren't random. Mm. I mean, they do come out randomly, but when they come out, it's going to be there on the beginning of the round. It's the new loans are drawn and placed on this track, and so everyone will see it clear as day. There's a Pyromancer available, and so it's not like you're going to be surprised when somebody takes it and uses it against you. You have to beat them to that. You have to, you know, raid their, try to find and raid that their messenger that they're sending with their sea order, or try to get a sea order off before they do, or try to steal their power. If you steal their power, and let's say it's in the seventh slot, right? If it's in the seventh slot and they have eight power, if you're just able to get them down to six, they won't be able to pay for that. And you know that. So there's all this interplay about how you can defend it, you know. If you see a card come out that you don't want to be used against you, there are ways. There are very interesting strategic ways to stop that from happening.
It's at the end of the turn, since you'd be consolidating. It'd be at the end of your orders that you actually access the bank. Okay,
that's it. So and because of this is a little bit. So in the base game, some of the consolidated power orders have the star on them, which allows you to muster in those areas, right?
Hmm.
But for the most part, there are some exceptions to this. But for the most part, it didn't really matter what order that consolidate power step happened in, because people would just kind of collect their power with the ones that didn't have the star. Didn't really matter the order. But now it does, because when it's your turn to resolve a consolidate power order, you have to choose, do I take the consolidate power order that gives me power, or do the Iron Bank one that actually spends it? Which order is important?
Hmm. Yeah, especially if you're close to the cost of getting it. I guess I was thinking, like, is a game saver use of it if someone's about to get 7? I guess if they just got 6 and it looks like they're going to get 7, you could use it there. Or you could use it just in general the weekend. I mean, you still have, then you end up having to pay the interest for it. So it's not like the best of moves, but it's a possible move that is there.
Yeah.
Okay. So I mean,
Interesting part about the interest too is if somebody's riding along at let's say they have a loan out, right? And they intentionally save one power token behind because they're going to use that to pay their interest in the next round. And you know that. And so you find where you can raid them and you raid them to get rid of that one power. And now all of a sudden they have to pay the bank something they can't afford and they get to lose the unit for it. So there's kind of interesting stuff you can do with that too.
Hmm. Or I mean, like the Danny card or something, a card that makes them lose power as well.
Yeah,
like
price to make
them lose power. Hmm. I suppose it could be like people begging for power and be like, hey, please give me 2 power. I'll do anything you want this turn. I just pay this interest. Okay, let's see here. We've talked about the game and how this, with the two houses, we have a full 8-player game here, and it's pretty awesome. But what I find interesting is the expansion actually focuses on all play sizes, all the way down to 3 players, with features like the vassal system, I think. So can we talk about the vassal system a bit?
So vassals are a new system that we made for, like you said, allowing to scale to any player number, in addition to not only any player number, but also allows any of the houses to be used at any given player number. Hmm. So if you want to, because currently the base game, if you're playing a 4-player game,
specific set house.
You play with a specific set.
Yeah.
You don't have a choice, right?
Yeah.
And if I know in a 5-player game, for example, you play with everything but Martell. You don't have a choice to play Martell in a 5-player game, for example. Now you do. If you have 5 players, you can choose the ones that you want to play with. And so if one player wants to play Martell, but nobody wants to play Stark, well, you can just not play Stark and move on and make them a vassal and play Martell instead. So that really allows a lot more versatility as far as the game setup. Choosing houses is a fun step of the game now because it's really this strategic, like, if I choose this one and they choose that one, oh, what's going to happen? You know. So anyways, the way the vassal system works is at the end of the everyone choosing houses, any of the houses that weren't chosen, except for Targaryen cannot be a vassal, but any of the houses that weren't chosen become vassals. And a vassal has a separate card that they set up their game with. They're going to start with more units than most houses normally do, but they'll start in their normal home area and the areas around it. And for the rest of the game, that house can be acquired by other players and manipulated by other players to do the players can make that house do their bidding. So they still are an independent house. They don't become that player's units, but for one turn at a time, the houses can be drafted into a player's allegiance and they can force that house to, for example, to attack an enemy or to defend their own territory or to set up a wall of defense around, you know, a key area. And that's done by the top of the Kingsguard track the top of the Iron Throne track. So the player at the top of that track is to choose which one of the available vassals is going to be their followers that round. Then the next player down gets to choose any remainder, and the next player gets to choose any remainder, and so on.
You can't attack your own vassal, I think, right? Like that's
correct.
If they leave a territory, they leave a token behind, I think.
And right? You can't take that as well. Yes, that is not.
That's the point of it. You can't just sandbag your vassal and take all their at least that turn anyway. Like there's time for people to react to it.
Yep. And in addition to that, after combat that involves one of your vassals is done, you can receive an award for using them correctly. So if your vassal wins the combat, either as the attacker or the defender, in either case, you can gain 1 power token just for free for having that vassal win. Hmm. So you want your vassals to win.
I'm trying to remember how, like, so when your vassal, you choose the vassal's a card, you choose a specific card in that battle, or you choose 3? Like, how does that...
So the vassals have, all of the vassals, regardless of house, share a 7-card vassal house deck.
Mm.
House card deck. And so those are unique cards that represent kind of neutral characters throughout the setting, like Varys, or Jaqen H'ghar, or Janos Slynt, John Connington, Beric Dondarrion, etc. And that seven card deck has effects just like all the rest of the cards do. They have a card strength just like all the rest of the other house cards do. But when your vessel's in combat, you'll actually draw the top three cards of that deck. You shuffle the deck every time. You draw the top three cards. And from those three, you'll choose which one you're going to play.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember you got Brawn in here. I remember Brawn.
Yep, Brawn's in there too, yeah.
What I remember is a lot of shuffling, because if people are batting a lot, you basically just shuffle after every battle, right, to get that
yep.
draw of three.
You never know. And there's 0, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, and 4, just like all the other house card decks. So you know there's a 4 in there, and you know you didn't draw it, but you're not quite sure, like, did the other player draw it? Or, you know, that 4 can come up every time, or it might not. You just have no idea. So the vassals play very unpredictable, I guess is the word.
Hmm. So if you win, a battle with him, you get a token. You said, but if you lose, you get
a power token.
Harm to that, or is that
there's not? No. Nope.
Okay, that's good. I think, because I think that was, you can get the benefit, but you don't have to worry about, like, if you're saddled with vassals, you don't have to worry about getting led because of the
exactly.
I don't think that would be fun. I guess, or it was determined that was not so fun.
We went back and forth on that rule regarding the vassals allowing you to acquire a power token. It was actually the reverse for a while. If your vassals lost, you also lost a token. But that was manipulated a little too heavily, and it caused people to just rain down on the vassals to cause the player to lose power.
Yeah.
And like I mentioned before, power is so important throughout the rest of this game that felt like a really cheap experience to have your vassal lose and then you couldn't pay a loan, you know?
Yeah, I don't think people it should be punished for playing with a vassal system. Like,
no. Yeah.
One of the uses, and I think you even talk about this in the rule book, is what if somebody's got to leave early, right? That happens in any board game. I got to go home or whatever, or I've lost horribly. I don't want to play. Rage quit. So what do you do there? They become a vassal. Right?
Yeah, that's really cool. It because these vassals can at any time just become neutral. Nothing really major needs to happen. Mm-hmm. You just take that vassal, that player that was playing there, and they can just instantly become an available draftable vassal. So yeah, if you got to leave early, which you know these games can take long sometimes. If you got to leave early, that's no problem.
When somebody starts to lose horribly, that's when they have to leave early. It makes sense. I mean, sometimes you have a bad game and you don't feel like coming back. Well, then you're not going to ruin the game by leaving. You can just become a vassal, and then people can basically prop you up like they would have anyway. So
it's a little harder to do, and I didn't specifically mention it in the rules. But we've also played around with and had some people try coming late, and they're like, "Oh, you guys are playing already?" And you go, "You know what? Sit down. Hey, I got a vassal right here. You want to play this?" And if they're cool with it, they're like, "Sure," and they jump in and immediately start playing. So. A little bit more wacky because you know that for however many rounds that vassal was not operating in the way you might have operated, but it's an interesting play center. Maybe it's a challenge.
That seems to me very good for a board game convention. You have a game that's going on for a while. People can hop in and hop out out of it. You could do it that way. Let's see here. That's kind of funny, actually. So you have a group of people, and then one person's coming late, and then one of the they just jump in and replace somebody. Well, it's kind of interesting.
I also haven't played around with it, but I thought it's kind of spitballing. I was like, what happens? There's like a special game where like everybody rotates, right? Like play three rounds and then shift seats and play the next house, and you know, like there's like vassals interspersed in there. I don't know, just silly stuff like that. Well, you know, people don't usually like playing stuff, but I always like to play silly little games like that.
Well, people, I mean, that's the thing with these games. People have their mods and their fan, like, play. Like, I mean, that's what we used to do in the day is sometimes just play with multiple houses. You control two houses.
Yeah.
That is actually, I mean, it takes longer because you got to do the full thing for every house. But the vassals are kind of the more simplified, control a house without all the details of controlling a house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think this is in the spirit of that, but, you know, superior to it. I mean, just seeing these options makes you like think, what can you do for fun and comedy? Like, the Iron Bank. Now I want to take the Iron Bank and play with it in A Feast for Crows and see what you can do there. I think that could be interesting. With, you know, modifying the map and stuff like that, right? Yeah, I need to get this thing. Well, I'll just modify the map to do so. I think it would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we talked about Deck 4 a bit. So Deck 4 is basically is Targaryen-based loyalty and dragon-related effects. But was there any thought to doing anything more with Deck 4? I mean, because some fan people have done so. Was there any thought to that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I created an alternate deck for Feast for Crows expansion.
That's right.
I think it was Deck 1 that we swapped out.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, like, there's definitely been thoughts of, like, just messing around with various mechanics in those Westeros decks. This is an easy way to do it. But I just thought with the Targaryen inclusion that we should keep it focused. Mm. And so it was, it's very, that deck four is very Targaryen heavy. It really revolves around all of the loyalty tokens and the dragons and whatnot. And I liked that was very succinct. And the other players basically are at the Targaryen's whim in that deck. They're affected sometimes a little bit, but it's all because of what the Targaryens are doing. And I liked how that was very tightly controlled.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the people that have had the fourth deck is sometimes people just put ridiculous things in there. They're like, oh, I have a fourth deck, let me just put things, and they're just not balanced. Like, there's nothing unbalanced with Targaryens. It's very specific, and it still adds, it changes the game each time because different cards are drawn, right? They're different places. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I guess what I have for you is just a couple of rules questions since we're talking about this. And then, of course, we can always come back in the future and chat some more. So, well, actually, before the rules question, so just the length of the game for 8 players. I mean, I think, how long do you imagine it lasting? Is it longer than 6? I think it has to be if you add more players, but that's if you want to play the full 8, right?
Okay, well, this is interesting. So, originally designing it up to 8 players, it was kind of like, this is probably going to add some time. If let's say the regular game takes, I don't know, 4 hours, I thought, oh, this is definitely going to start pushing 5 or 6 for sure if you're going to add the player number. But it doesn't. And that it surprised me, shocked me, but it's true. It does not take longer. And I think one of the reasons why, as you start to like break it down and analyze why, is the Targaryens actually act as this timer almost. With those dragons coming and becoming stronger as the game goes on, players are encouraged to push the game forward and to not dally around and just like and to turtle up and to kind of slowly expand. You gotta be on top of your game because you got this coming threat that all the players have to kind of be aware of. And so as a result, the game very, very rarely I've noticed pushes past like round 8. Or 7, even 7 sometimes. So the game will end a little bit quicker than some of the other games. And as a result, you're not looking at extended. It doesn't usually, in my experience, add too much to the playtime.
That is interesting because I don't play the base game as much since I play mostly Feast for Crows now. But that's what I noticed with the base game is with experienced players, you kind of end up going for that 10th turn tiebreak. You don't have as many immediate wins, but you can't do that. If you want to go to the 10th turn time break here, the Targaryens will be too powerful, so I think you have to be more aggressive on average. This is probably what happened, I guess, is they were people more aggressive. They either won or then somebody else took advantage of somebody being aggressive to get the 7.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, Targaryens love to go to 10 turns because then they have 5 strength dragons to.
Yep.
And they're probably really close to winning at that point, right? Oh, I wonder how does a tiebreak work? Well, if the Targaryens just get it, they just win immediately, like in the middle of the turn, right? There's not really a tiebreak with Targaryens and the rest, right? They would just.
Just like everybody else, when they reach the 7th spot on that victory track, they win. No holds barred. So just like everybody else, if you get that 7th castle, you're done.
That's right.
You win. You know.
Yes. But if they were at 6 with everybody, then it would just be the regular tiebreak rules, I guess.
So that's something they should be taken into consideration because the regular tiebreak rules do actually revolve around. Hold on, let me see.
I think it was most strongholds has become first over supply.
Correct, yes.
I actually preferred supply, I think, because strongholds is not as distributed as equally. But they probably, the 10th turn and they have strong dragons, they're a good place to go in and hopefully probably get 7 right then. So.
Yep.
Okay, so let's just do some rules questions since we have you here. I'm sure there's going to be many rules questions going forward. So we talked about gifting power tokens, that can happen. Even if you the cards are revealed and says Clash of Kings, right? Before you actually start bidding, you can gift the tokens. But could you then do them between like each bid, the 3 rounds? Or
this is not specifically stated in the rules. I think it'll probably be added to the FAQ that's coming out because it is a good question to ask. There are some obvious areas where you can't change top tokens, and I think the general way to state this is that. In any point of a resolution, such as, for example, the resolution of the bidding for the tracks, the tokens cannot be changing hands. Mm. It could happen before that, but as soon as you reveal your tokens, you're in the process of resolving. Yeah. There's no window there to do anything.
But I mean, let's say you've done the bid on the Iron Throne that's complete, and you've moved around people around. Can you exchange tokens before the fiefdom's bid?
Yeah. Yes, I think you could. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. I mean, I guess it's something that might be interesting to spell in the fact. Since it's an interesting question. I mean, what I find related to this, I mean, there's somebody who said, like, back in the classic game, you know, when you have a bid, you reveal how many tokens you have, right? The way I've always played it is, so you reveal how many tokens you have, you do the bid on the Iron Throne, and then you just keep revealing before each bid, because to do the alternative, it's just like, well, people will just write it down. Like, it's just a waste of time. Just like, you have the bid, just say the amount, your updated amounts, right? Like, that seems to me to be the logical approach.
We don't want to reward people for being good bean counters, you know?
Yeah. And that seems to be what we all went there. But So if you updated the power between ones, you still have to see how much you have, right? It'd be obvious. You can't be, like, hiding power and, like, secretly, like, giving power. Exchange of power is public, I think, right? Like, you can't secretly exchange power.
No, you have to tell people. Yeah. Also, it's not binding. A lot of rules talk about binding contracts between players. There is no rule about that, and that's intentional.
Yes.
This is supposed to be, do you trust the player to do what they said to do? And if they said, hey, I'll give you 2 power to attack that guy, and then you didn't take the power beforehand, and they attack the guy, and you decide not to give them the power, like, that's not binding. Like,
that's right.
That's Game of Thrones, man.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that being said, like, if you do that in turn one, well, the guy's never going to try to see the rest of the game, right? Like, you use common sense on it. let's see. So the Targaryen loyalty tokens, initially when we were playing them and testing, we figured them out. I mean, like, you can have more than one of them in actually one territory, right? They could be stacked in one territory, right?
Yep. So they spawn uniquely in different areas across the board, but a lot of the effects on deck four Westeros, the Westeros deck four, move them. And so they can move and cluster together sometimes, depending on how those effects resolve. And that's interesting, because now you got a 3-point, let's say it happens where three of them cluster together. That's a 3-point victory swing in Targaryen's favor if they were to take that. That puts a huge burden to defend against dragon attacks, you know? Mm. And the entire board will kind of come together to agree to do that.
Yeah, I manipulated to my effect. Like I would, for example, put 2 of them in one area that I control and say, okay, you guys support me here now. So you can at the same time put it to your advantage, or you shouldn't attack me here, or you should, or if it's on your opponent's core territory, they have to shift units there to guard it, and then their front is not as protected.
Yep.
So it's just so much, manipulation and stuff there. Okay, so then Targaryens can control vassals as well. I think they can control vassals, right?
It's possible. It is not likely. So what happens, because they're on the bottom of the tracks, the only way they're going to be able to control vassals is if everybody else passes on them.
Yes.
And so the vassals will just kind of fall to the bottom of the track, and the Targaryens have to take them. They can't. The Targaryens cannot pass on the vassal, and so they'll take the vassals in that case. That's pretty rare, but it can happen.
What reason would there be to avoid taking a vassal, other than you might be wanting to head in that direction? I'm trying to think, is there no other disadvantage? Well,
that is a big deal. Like,
yes.
Sometimes, like, for example, if you might have spent a large portion of the game building a vassal up on one side of your borders, right, to create a barrier, to create a safe wall. Well, all of a sudden, the game reaches its later stages, and that's desperately area that you now need, because everything else is closed up. You have to get rid of that vassal and attack it. And so it's important to be able to pass a vassal off and say, I'm going to attack that vassal now.
So if a vassal is passed all the way to the bottom, is it then the Targaryens are stuck with it? Like they would have to take it? Yeah, that makes sense, I guess. Okay, so is that it for the rules? Oh, there was one other real question. So the Targaryens, you said, typically they can't lose victory points, but I think there is one way they can, right? I think if they take Pentos, or was it one of the...
They start with 1 victory point on the Pentos space, which is their home area. And it's printed on the board.
So if that's taken, then they go down by that amount.
It's taken, yeah, because then that's the only way that they can go down.
Mm. None of the other points could go down because they just claim.
Yeah.
When they claim that, so you claim that Targaryen token, then it goes back to the pool. And it can be placed again, though, right?
Yes. Yep, the loyalty tokens, yep.
Yeah, because otherwise you could run out, so I guess that's important, yeah. Question there. So that's it for my question. Is there a rule question that comes to mind to you that you want to talk about, or is that it for right now. And I guess you have the fact.
No, I don't think I had anything particular. I think we covered everything from the game that I found worth talking about.
Okay, let me just see if there's a couple of quick questions that I gathered from online. So the playmat is coming out the same time as the expansion? Is it expected to be or is it roughly the same time, or is it going to be sometime down the line?
Because of the varying markets, I can't speak to that. Mm.
I mean,
I can speak to one market or another, but sure. I can't speak to them all.
Yeah, I mean, so. By the time this episode comes out, it might be out.
Anyway, yep, so I guess yep.
Okay, and so I guess officially it's not compatible with the two expansions, but people, I assume, could try it out themselves for fun.
Are you talking about this expansion or the mat?
The expansion, sorry. Yeah.
Yes, so the expansion is specifically compatible in the sense that there is a spot in there that talks about how to combine the different house cards to form, like I mentioned, the early and late deck. Mm. And so, brief summary, just to kind of give you an overview of the different combinations. The base game deck plus the decks in this pack, in this expansion, that one Aaron and one Targaryen deck from this expansion, create the early game deck set. Hmm. If you want the late game deck set, you need the Dance with Dragons expansion, the Feast for Crows expansion, and this expansion for the Targaryen set. That's how that works.
Okay, well, that makes sense. I mean, so in terms of the playmat, then, it would work with all of them except potentially the bite is added.
Yeah, the only thing that... the Aaron space, the new Aaron spaces that I mentioned, with the bite and the Veil of Aaron Eyrie spaces, those are printed on the board, on this playmat.
Mm.
That's the only thing in the mat, other than Essos, that is... that you might have a problem with. I personally don't. Like, I would still play the Feast for Crows game with that Aaron area.
If you're buying the playmat, I assume you have the base game because you need the cards from the base game. So you could always
use
the base.
Oh, yeah. You absolutely need, yeah.
Or you could play the one with the bite as a variant for Feast for Crows.
You just need the base game for tokens. Like, you can't play the game without the base game. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, you must. I mean, if you're getting the playmat... Like, You can't be playing Feast for Crows without the base game. You need all the cards and everything from it, right? So.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have, Jason. Is there anything you want to talk about in terms of how did you start doing this expansion or what inspired it? Or
it was it's been a long time in the works working on this thing, which is I've done those other two small print on demand expansions, and while doing those, this expansion was in my mind.
Hmm.
And so it was just constantly percolating throughout, 7 years now since I think the base game came out. And throughout that entire time, I'm like, what are Targaryens? What do they do? Like, how do they come into the game? Do they matter? Are they stronger? Are they? And I was just constantly chewing on different options. Like, and this has been a long time coming.
Yeah, and it's great to see. I mean, as I said, it's the biggest change to the game since the first edition. So. Since it came out, so it's going to be. I'm looking forward to playing and all the different having the ability to for people to leave or to play with the smaller groups with vassals. It's going to be really interesting. So
one thing I just mentioned. It's worth mentioning. The Feast for Crows expansion, as you mentioned, plays with Aaron, but it uses the Tyrell pieces as a replacement. Now you have all the Aaron pieces, the blue plastic and the blue punch.
Yes,
I just thought I'd mention that.
Oh, yeah. So you can always take those pieces and then play when you're playing the four player. Yeah.
Yep. That's cool. Yep. So that Feast for Crows game now becomes a complete experience as well.
Yeah.
Which I know you mentioned you like that one. So.
Yeah, because I 3D printed my ones. In the
pool. Oh, you did? Yeah.
I did. Right. But I mean, it's nice to have that so that everyone now has the Aaron pieces. So, yeah. Good point. Okay. Thank you so much, Jason, for joining us. It was a lot of fun. And we'll have you on again maybe down the line. To chat about this again, or if you want to chat about the show books.
I'm super excited for those books, for the show and the books. Yeah.
Thanks, Jason. Mm-hmm. Cheers. This is going the after show, just a couple of minutes. We're going to discuss Fire and Blood. People are still reading Fire and Blood and may want to read it first and come here. Do you have a copy of Fire and Blood right now?
I'm listening to it on Audible, yep.
Oh, Audible, cool, yeah.
Started it.
Yeah, it's... Well, the thing is, with Audible, though, you don't get to see the artwork. You're missing out on some of the artwork.
Oh, there's artwork in there? I didn't even realize.
Yeah, you should at least take a look at a print copy. There is... It's like the... I don't know if you saw the Game of Thrones, the illustrated edition, but it has art for every chapter, plus, like, it's more than that. It's between that and the World of Ice and Fire. So not as much art as World of Ice and Fire.
Not quite as big as the World of Ice and Fire, though?
It's between that and the illustrated edition. But it is, I think as Kyle put it, like, every 15 pages there should be something there, and that's about right, looks like it.
Interesting.
So, there's some freaky art in there. Like, what the heck is going on here? So you probably should
finished it?
No, because it's like 700 pages, so I've read good chunks of it. I guess is your question, do we learn anything that's relevant to the present, right? I think it is, because, so in terms of Fire and Blood, does it affect the present timeline? It has a couple issues. Like, one is, I don't know if you read in World of Ice and Fire where Aegon the Dragon, like the first, you know, he was fighting with the Dornish, and he had this long war, and then suddenly he kind of stops, like this letter comes to him. And he stops, and everybody wonders why. Well, it mentions that again and adds a few more theories. I think the fact that it's highlighted is something important. I think that could affect, like, why did Aegon stop? Like, my initial theory was that they stole a dragon horn, like, from Dornish stole it from Dragonstone. Mm. So then he had to back off. And then that could be relevant if there's still one in Dorne, or it just shows the power of dragon horns. Well, then you should be wary of them. And then Euron has.
So then the one Euron has may actually be real, you know?
Yeah, not necessarily it's the same one, but it's just saying, like, these things are powerful, they could scare the Targaryens, right? And they did, and that probably is long lost, but then Euron's is, yeah, the real deal, something serious. But now I'm thinking that it might even be dragon eggs. They might have stolen dragon eggs, because dragon eggs are stolen in the Fire and Blood, and that's an issue. In fact, Dany's dragon eggs are stolen. That shows how they first came into, like, over to the Essos. And the Targaryens are concerned. They're not like, oh, like only Targaryens can use it. They're concerned, like, well, if people hatch them, they'll probably form a bond, and then we could have other dragon raiders. So I think maybe the Dornish stole some eggs and threatened to use them, like they would hatch them or maybe send them all over the place.
Where did Dany get the eggs from?
They're given to her by Illyrio as a gift, because they were.
But where did he get them from?
Well, you find out in the book, Fire and Blood. Like those three eggs were stolen and sold, and they're passed around. And it just shows how they were stolen, and then it's a real concern for the Targaryens. Like Jaehaerys is thinking, well, this is basically what he says, if they hatch these dragons, they're going to be a threat, and we either have to get them back, or if they don't, we got to attack right away and just burn the city, like take them out, like before they grow up. It's like whoa, like this is really serious there. So they are concerned that they could be used. They're not like, oh, only we can use them. They're concerned that if they were raised from eggs, then people could actually control them, right? It's a lot easier to pair with them if you get them from eggs. So they're thinking, well, if they actually start breeding dragons, we could just got to go in and nuke the place basically before they can develop the dragons to adult age. They won't be able to.
Interesting.
So it gives that, and then, but it is it's the first half of the book, so it doesn't get to like Duncan Egg and stuff. But there's a couple of things in here that could potentially tie to later things, I think.
Oh, when does it terminate? When does the book end?
It gets to when Aegon Dragonbane, Aegon the Third, I think, gets. It goes through like first is the Regency, which is all new material, and then when he formally like gets into power, he's like, now I'm ruling. Then it ends there. So just the start of Aegon the Third's rule.
I just read the Knight in the Seven Kingdoms series again on Audible, and they're just so good. I was almost disappointed when I found out that the HBO series wasn't that.
Yeah, I mean, I want the next one of that, right? They are so good, right? They're so. I initially did not like. The third one as much, and then I reread it, and I really liked it. Like, there's so much depth in the movie. Episode for that was years later, in terms of I don't know if you, I think we had this discussion before, but I mean, Bloodraven is there in the third book. He's actually like in disguise doing all the stuff there.
Yep.
In the third book, and I didn't get that the first time I read it. It took a while to get that. Okay, well, great. I mean, we'll have to have you back on sometime for this kind of discussion.
All right, take it easy.